I teach chemistry at Pacific Lutheran University, and periodically I take students to Australia, and what you're going to see today are some slides that are a conglomerate of trips when I've been in Australia myself with my husband, and also when I've been in Australia with students. I'm taking students again this January for the month, and we'll be doing a trip very similar to what I'm going to talk about today. Needless to say, everybody recognizes the Sydney Opera House and its unique profile. It really strikes you as you get to Sydney Harbour as the sign of Australia, and I think every student I take must leave Australia with at least two t-shirts or sweatshirts with an outline of the Sydney Opera House on it. As you can see, it has a beautiful view of the water, and you get a beautiful view looking toward it from the water. There are two portions to it. One portion is the Symphony Hall, one portion is the Opera House, and then down inside are a whole series of little theaters. If you're ever in Sydney, I really highly recommend you take a tour of it, even if you're not able to go to a performance, and better yet, if you can, go to a performance as well. How many of you have been in Australia? Like I say, he's here to keep me honest. But yes.
That's why we came, actually.
That's right.
Not really, Elsa.
One thing you'll find about Australians are that they're very, very honest people, but they do pull your leg a lot. This is the Opera House from the shore side. How many of you want to go to Australia? Good choice. I find it one of the most wonderful countries in the world, if not the most wonderful country in the world to travel in. Australians are real pros at traveling and make it very easy. Australia really is a land of contrasts. From the north, where it's very, very wet, this happens to be on the Daintree River, north of the northernmost city on the east coast, Cairns, and I'll have a map a little bit later on, where that's really true jungle up from the river, to not very far west at all, just over the Great Dividing Range when you start to get out into plains that are very, very dry. This day they promised us 45 degrees centigrade, and it only got up to 44 degrees centigrade. Keep in mind that body temperature is 37.5 degrees centigrade, and you get some idea of how hot it can get out that direction. This happened to be a sheep station. Here's a map of Australia that I'd like to spend just a couple of minutes on. Australia has six states and two internal territories and some external territories. The six states are, of course, Queensland, New South Wales, Victoria, South Australia, Western Australia, and Tasmania. And the two internal territories are Northern Territory and Australian Capital Territory, where the nation's capital, Canberra, is located. The external territories include Norfolk Island. What else? Not to put you on the spot.
Part of the Antarctic, is it?
Yeah, part of the Antarctic, etc. Right. Australia has about 16 million people, and just think of that in comparison to the United States with our population of over 200 million people, because the landmass of Australia is almost identical to that of the landmass of our lower 48 states. So the population density is very, very sparse if you were to distribute people across the entire continent. They're not, however, distributed across the entire continent. This map shows you a population distribution. And you can see that the population is largely distributed right along the coast. The five most populous cities contain 85% of the people who live in Australia. So it's really a very urban nation with very, very, very few people spread across the bulk of the continent. The largest cities are Brisbane, just right on the edge of Queensland, also the capital of Queensland, Sydney, Melbourne, Perth. The areas which I've spent the most time in are the states of New South Wales and Queensland, particularly in the north of Queensland, around the tropical city of Cairns, and there'll be some a number of shots of that, and across the Great Dividing Range in the north, and pretty much throughout the state of New South Wales. Like I say, it's a big country, and hard to manage to see the whole thing. When we were staying in Cairns one time, in an island off Cairns, actually, we ran into a couple of German students who'd spent the past 2.5 years traveling around Australia and were just beginning to feel like they had seen the country. Western Australia, up in this region, Port Hedland, Broome area, is an area that I would really like to spend some time in the future, and it's kind of the area where tourism is beginning to boom in the west. But it's, if you consider from Perth to up in this region, it's, you know, 1,500 miles, right? Something like that. So keep in mind, distances are very, very large. Everybody wants to go to Alice Springs, which of course is in Northern Territory, and only about a 7 or 8 hour drive to Ayers Rock. We've never been to Northern Territory, largely because of the cost of getting there and the heat of going to Northern Territory in the summer. Sydney is a very modern, very large city, about 3.5 million people. It's also probably the most water-oriented city I've ever been in the world. I've never been to Hong Kong, which is probably more water-oriented than Sydney, but Sydney really faces on the water. This is Port Jackson, right in downtown Sydney, in an area called the Circular Quay, where the elevated trains run through and ferries come out of here. And I'll show you some shots of ferries in a little bit. I'd like to talk a little bit about the urban environment before we get to the rural environment of Australia, because as many of you know, I'm really interested in water quality issues, and Australia has lots of water quality and water quantity issues. Sydney gets its water supply from the Great Dividing Range. The reservoir that supplies Sydney has an 8-year supply of water. If they had no water whatsoever, Sydney would have 8 years worth of water that they could get from that reservoir. That's the kind of planning that goes on in Australia because of the fact that water is very limited. Rainfall in Australia is on average about, the total amount of rainfall in Australia is about 1/10 the amount of rainfall we get here if we were to add up all of the rain. Most of that falls in that thin strip along the coast that I showed in the last slide. Like I say, Sydney Harbor is beautiful. Sailing is extremely popular. Ferries are a major source of transportation and a really wonderful way to get around Sydney Harbor. The ferries are people-oriented ferries, not car-oriented ferries. This is the, is it the governor's home?
Yep.
And that was in right near the center of Sydney in the Botanical Gardens. This is part of the oldest part of Sydney called the Rocks, which was the first area settled and was an area where the convicts, the first convicts, were brought, and they were involved in building some of the stone buildings. This was the Garrison Church, is the Garrison Church in the Rocks, a lovely church inside and a beautiful place to cool off on a hot day. A view of the second most famous site in Sydney, the Sydney Harbour Bridge, also again in the Rocks. The oldest hotel in Sydney. The observatory on top of Observatory Hill in Sydney, a place I really recommend visiting because you can get free star charts there to figure out the stars in the southern hemisphere. Something that's a real surprise when you get away from the cities and look up and the stars just don't look the same. I was really fascinated by the hotels in Australia and have, I just stuck in a couple of slides, but I have a whole collection of slides of the hotels. They really have some interesting architecture. Sydney is also a major, major world port, and this is just across the hill from the rocks, just down from the observatory, and you can see all the containerized shipping that goes in and out of the port of Sydney. Sydney has some interesting pollution problems as well. Australians are very focused on their beaches, because so many Australians live along the coast, and Sydney is by no exception. One of the most popular beaches in Sydney is Bondi Beach, another one is Manly Beach. Unfortunately, both are located very near Sydney's wastewater treatment plants. Those wastewater treatment plants are not very adequate. For those of you into wastewater treatment, they have only primary treatment and then pipe the wastes out to sea. Under certain conditions, those wastes blow back up on the beaches, particularly small grease balls, and Sydneysiders are very, very unhappy about the fact that their beaches are being severely impacted by the sewage. The officials in Sydney are planning to do something about it, a solution I don't think is a very good one, and that is build longer pipes to move the materials further out to sea. That may work. It has not been very successful elsewhere, and I think in the end they'll probably end up installing secondary wastewater treatment. But those are the kinds of issues that the people of the urban areas in Australia are beginning to grapple with now. Issues identical to the issues we grapple with in Puget Sound, in Los Angeles, in New York, in Boston. Likewise, the New South Wales Water Pollution Control Board has become very concerned about contaminated sediments in the Sydney Harbour. Some of the same issues we're concerned about in Seattle right now. I'm also intrigued by fireboats, and that happens to be one of the Sydney Harbour fireboats, and I thought it was a nifty one. The site you could see just before, let me back up, that's looking across at North Sydney. Of course, there's industry in Sydney, and they have outfalls. This happens to be one outfall, which was for a local industry. This is actually on Botany Bay, south of Sydney Harbour, rather than in Sydney Harbour. New South Wales Water Pollution Control Board has gotten very interested in controlling pollution from these outfalls, and the number of outfalls coming into Sydney Harbour and into Botany Bay has dropped by about four-fifths, or to one-fifth the number they had in 1980. Unfortunately, some of that waste has been controlled, but unfortunately a good share of it has just been piped into the Sydney Municipal Wastewater Treatment System, so now it's getting discharged at sea instead of into the bays. That's one of the hydrofoils that runs around Sydney Harbour. Like I say, a really nifty way to get around. This is Botany Bay. People confuse Botany Bay and Sydney Harbour, and I should have thought to bring a map up here, but once you get up here and don't have a map, you're kind of out of luck. Sydney Harbour is on the north side. The bulk of Sydney and suburbs are in between, and Botany Bay is south. And the airport is right by Botany Bay. Botany Bay, of course, is where Captain Cook first landed, and there's a memorial to Cook on the south side, the south entrance to Botany Bay. La Perouse, the Frenchman who got there just after Cook, landed on the north side, and there's a memorial to him on the north side and a nice little museum there. Much of the heavy industry in Sydney is located on Botany Bay. And because of that, again, the sediments in Botany Bay are contaminated and of great concern in the New South Wales Water Pollution Control Board. You can also see some air pollution, and unfortunately, Sydney, like the rest of the world, suffers from some. This is a shot in the center of Sydney at the Circular Quay, and for the bicentenary, the site was dramatically remodeled and lots of plantings put in, and it's really lovely. You can see it looks tropical. Sydney is subtropical with a climate very much like that of, say, Santa Barbara. When you fly into Sydney, it's lovely. There are red roofs on a lot of the buildings. One of the little buskers who was playing on the circular quay at Sydney Harbour, there are lots of buskers. Ambry was saving for her new piano, and hey, the next time I was in Australia, there was a little article in the newspaper that she'd gotten her new piano, and she played very well. This is some of the street theater in Sydney. Nobody I talked to ever quite understood what this was all about, but it was protesting the capitalistic exploitation of workers. And this is a big cast iron drum, and yes, this is a person strapped on it. You'll be able to see it a little bit better in the next one. And they pull this up and down the sidewalk in front of the circular quay every day for a week or so. And it was certainly dramatic with a lot of tourists looking at it. There she goes over the top and came up the other side. And they seem to be surviving. Anyway, I'd never quite seen anything like it elsewhere in the world. Here's a slide that shows the water distribution. The clear area is arid, the light stipple is semi-arid, and the heavy stipple is non-arid. And you can see that a very large portion of the continent is indeed arid. And as I said before, it's the thin strip along the coast that gets the most rainfall. The Great Dividing Range runs as a spine right down the coast, and it's a very, very old mountain range. If Jill were here, she'd probably tell me how old it is. I can't remember. It's old. A lot of the mountains are very rounded. No recent volcanoes like you see in the Cascades, but it acts as a very effective block for the prevailing winds and the clouds coming in, and those clouds dump their moisture. There's a town up north, for instance, ways north of Townsville, called Tully, and just outside of Tully, they get about 300 inches of rain a year. That's the wettest point in Australia. I would guess out here in the red center, what do they get? A couple of inches every few years?
Some areas, yeah.
Very, very dry. In the north, the rainfall can be fairly heavy, but because it's so close to the equator and the sun is overhead so much of the time, it takes a lot of rainfall to keep the area wet. Well, we took off on a bus trip through New South Wales, and these were some of the Australians with us. This is our bus driver, Phil Roach, and his wife, Anita, and they're going to be our driver, and she's our cook on this next trip as well. And the naturalist who goes with us, Jeff Saney, who is an outstanding Australian naturalist and has published a number of books on the natural history of New South Wales. We headed down the coast. As you can see, parts of it are very rugged and extremely beautiful in both New South Wales and Victoria. And we camped. It was a little bit like camping on the Oregon or Washington coast some Julys. This was January in the middle of summer, and we had some rain and a bit of cold weather, but that evaporated, and we went into the Great Dividing Range and through it. It took a long time for explorers to get through the Great Dividing Range because there are a lot of canyons, but very often you come to a dead end in a sharp bluff. And the escarpment was very, very difficult to find a way through. This is in Morton National Park, and this is Fitzroy Falls. After you get through the Great Dividing Range, typical thing to do is to head for the nation's capital, Canberra. Canberra is a planned city. It was designed to be located roughly equidistant between Sydney and Melbourne, because of course neither one of them wanted the other to be the capital of the country. It's a very lovely city with planned residential areas and a fantastic embassy row with just beautiful embassy houses. The U.S. Embassy, by the way, is Virginia Colonial in style, with a gigantic fence around it, pretty ugly fence.
But a very nice house.
Have you been in it?
Yes, we've been around the grounds.
Oh.
We've been in it. Oh, I have.
I wasn't invited in.
They'll have open days. Oh. All the embassies are open and you can go through them.
Oh, neat. Do you know when they are?
About twice a year, various embassies do it for charity.
Yeah. The Botanical Gardens in Canberra is a really nice one because it focuses entirely on Australian native plants. I didn't stick in any slides of it, but I highly recommend visiting the Botanical Gardens. This is a shot from the War Memorial down toward the Old and New Parliament, where the Old Parliament is across the bottom and the New Parliament frames it on top. Australians have strong opinions about New Parliament, right?
Very symbolical. It's one of the few buildings in the world where people can walk on top of their politicians. I think that's a good thing. Got grass going on.
But this shows you some of the beauty of Canberra. The War Memorial, which I didn't stick in a slide of, is just behind this. And while it's a very serious place because it's a museum to war and has a memorial to war, it's also a fascinating museum, particularly when it comes to Gallipoli and Tobruk, which are two major battles that are very important to Australians because of the major role they played in fighting those battles. This is a shot of New Parliament. Beautiful artwork around it. As you can see, it was a pretty lousy day when we were there, unfortunately. It's kind of dark inside, and I know this is a little bit out of focus, but this is the only part, this is the entrance to New Parliament. And the idea is that these posts are to represent eucalyptus trees. This is the only part of New Parliament, the New Parliament building, that used non-Australian materials because to get the appropriate color green marble, they apparently had to go out of Australia, but the rest of the museum, the rest of Parliament uses Australian materials. So the wall hanging in the big reception room, and it's a fantastic wall hanging, 100 feet long, wide, something like that, maybe wider than that, with the artist's faces woven into this giant tapestry. Is this the lower house?
No, it's the Senate.
This is the Senate, okay. All done in wool. And that's the house then. Just shows you a little bit of the outside, some of the courtyards in the new parliament. Was it completed in 89?
Yeah, that's right.
Carillon on Lake Burley Griffith, which is the lake that winds its way through Canberra. That's the court, federal court,
yeah.
Right? Right across the street from the federal court is the National Museum, National Gallery, which has some really excellent Aboriginal bark paintings, which I just stuck in one example. It's an excellent art museum. After spending our time in the cities, we like to get out and camp out, and that's what we spend most of our trip in Australia doing. We travel by bus with our little one-minute tents. This is just south of Canberra on a river called the Goobergandra. This was another site actually a little bit north of, well, just south of, again, south of Canberra and just north of Cooma on the Numerilla River. And those rivers, among others, are related to a big water distribution scheme in Australia, and it's called the Snowy River Scheme. At PUMA, the headquarters for the Snowy River Scheme has an excellent exhibit, and I also recommend it if you're there, and particularly if you're interested in water quantity related issues. The purpose of the Snowy River Scheme was mainly to move water from the Great Dividing Range westward into the area that didn't have much water, so a major irrigation project. In addition, it generates electricity. But high in the mountains are some reservoirs. Here are a couple, Lake Yukonbine is one, with pipes or tunnels that go through the mountains to interconnect them. Then, from the reservoirs, there are power stations through which the water drops out into lower reservoirs, and then from there the water is diverted into the irrigation system in areas like the Murrumbidgee Irrigation Area, or MIA. The Kuma Visitor Center has a very amusing tape that was made in the 1950s of the construction of all this that gives you some idea of the complexity of it. And it's amusing because every time one of these tunnels was kind of christened, they managed to get some kind of royalty or prime minister there to make something blast or open. And very often they blow off their hard hats in the process. But at any rate, this shows you some of the countryside and some of the dams. I think that, let's see, I'm not going to remember the names of this.
That's
I think
the
this, this one's the Yukonbine. The last one, I think, was the Taubingo Dam. This is the Tumut 3 Power Station. This is a powerhouse for the Tumut Power Station. And some of the countryside around there as you're going through the Great Dividing Range. That's called a ute, the utility, the vehicle. We also look at water in some other ways. This is also going through the Great Dividing Range in the edge. This is the Goober Gander River again. The Murrumbidgee Irrigation Area is a fascinating area. I'm going to talk about it for just a minute. But this is one of the research centers that's run by the Australian government research arm, or CSIRO. And in this example right here, they were actually developing a new wastewater treatment system where wastewater from a household could be pumped into this cylindrical container, bubble down through rocks, and grass planted in it to consume the wastes purified the water. And then they had a pipe coming out the other side where the water really was indeed nice and clean. And I stuck this slide in because I was thinking maybe we could build something like this for Holden to take care of our wastewater problems here. This is an example of some of the irrigation. This happened to be on a prune farm, one of Australia's three large prune farms. I'm interested in prunes because my grandfather grew them for many years. This was a rice paddy, and this was the gentleman who owns the rice paddy, and he was explaining rice cultivation to us. Australia is a major rice producer. Another shot of the rice paddy. This is in the Murrumbidgee Irrigation Area. And a lot of fruits are grown there as well. This happens to be in a vineyard where the grapes were used for wine production. And again, you can see the palm tree, a good indication that the area is pretty temperate. There were a lot of oranges, apricots, peaches, etc., grown out there, and it very, very, very seldom actually drops below freezing in winter out there. A surprise to me when I considered it to be, it felt initially like it was a little bit like, say, going over here to Yakima, but later concluded that it was probably more like the area around Fresno in California. You really can see koalas in the wild. All of these shots were of a koala in the wild. This one seemed to be very, very old. We watched it for about an hour. So it slowly climbed the tree.
They're not always too bright. It kept going up the smaller and smaller branch. Anyway, it was really fun to watch it.
Actually, they're nocturnal. They sleep during the day.
In a guidebook, and the guidebook said, koalas are often plentiful in this area. And I looked 10 feet ahead, and there was a koala sitting there. You also see kangaroos in Australia. This one was at the Pioneer Museum in Griffith, which is in the Murrumbidgee Irrigation Area, and was obviously a pet. Got photographed a lot. That's closest I've gotten to a wombat, that's the whole. A commercial slide of a wombat. I was surprised, I saw them at the zoo, but I was surprised how big they were. This is a wallaby. Fantastic bird life. Anybody who's a birder and hasn't been to Australia is making a giant mistake. I'm not much of a birder, but even I got into keeping track of all the birds that I saw in my bird book, and I was with a guy who's an active Audubonner, an active birder, my co-leader on my last trip, and he added 177 birds to his life list, new sightings of birds to his life list. This was in the north, pelicans. The Australian version of the crow, this is called the galah, a kind of cockatoo. Farmers aren't always real happy with them because they fly in giant flocks, but I think you'd agree they're a little prettier than crows.
They're very dumb.
We also saw lots of big flocks of white cockatoos. What are they called? Golden crested? The white ones with the gold?
Sulfur crested.
Crested cockatoos. Kookaburra?
It's the largest kingfisher, I
think. The largest kingfisher, right. We saw lots of nifty kingfishers in the north. I think that's a bower bird, right?
That's a magpie.
Magpie, okay. This is a bower, though.
Yeah.
Male bower birds use bowers to attract female bower birds. This is the actual bower to which they want to attract them, not used for nesting, but for attracting the female. This stuff is what the male bird gathers. Now, what it did before plastics was gather blue feathers, and there are a couple you can kind of see here. We rearranged the plastics here a little bit because we wanted to, you know, kind of bring out the fact that there was a Bic razor right here, and there were a bunch of milk rings from milk bottles here, and of course the bottle caps and the drinking straws, etc. So we rearranged it. We moved the clothespin in. The next day we came back and everything was back where it had been before. We had obviously screwed up the bird's bower. This was another bower in the north for a different species of bower bird. And notice that this one uses shells. It also had some red plastic milk rings, a red straw, a lot of shells here. Inside the bower, however, was another example of a human product. It was full of broken glass. The bower was decorated, however, with fresh hibiscus flowers. And during the couple of days we were around this bower, those flowers were replaced regularly. This is a difficult picture to see, but this is from the golden bower bird. And this was deep in the rainforest. It was very, very dark. This is an unused bower, but it was about that high. The naturalist who was with us here, Andrew Haffenden, said that he'd been coming back to this bower for about 12 years and had been used for 10 years.
Also beautiful butterfly life. These are taken in the north. This is a commercial slide of Australia's largest butterfly, the blue Ulysses. I could never get one to stand still long enough for me to take a picture of it. I've never been able to. Also in the north, because it's rainforest and tropical, there are a lot of interesting fungi, and I happen to be very interested in fungi from a scientific point of view, or mushrooms. Whoops, one disappeared. This was, again, a lot of focus because it's deep in the forest. This was about an inch high, inch and a half high, and had this very, very fine veil over it. And one of my students was trying to stand it up to get a little bit better picture, and it released the most obnoxious smell I have ever encountered. I tried to bring it home, but it, or tried to preserve it, but it rotted very quickly. That ought to focus better than that. There's an amethyst python right here. It's about 6 feet long. Strangest reptile I've ever seen. Its head is here, its tail is there. Called the Boyd's Forest Dragon. Also something we saw in Mossman Gorge, just north of Cairns, in the rainforest.
How big is that?
Well, like so, including its tail. Its head is completely surrounded by plates. It could be used in a for close-ups in a monster movie. Lots of interesting flora in Australia as well. Flora in Australia as well. This is a bottle brush, a eucalyptus tree, of which there are, what, 700 species of eucalyptus?
Something like that, yeah.
Whole bunch. Acacia, of which there are 500 or 600 species. Eucalyptus and acacia are two very, very common plants in Australia. Fantastic tree ferns. These grow to, what, 10, 12 feet tall? In the rainforest, in the Great Dividing Range. One of the most interesting palms we encountered, this is called the Wait a While. It seems to have a thorn on every surface of every branch and every frond on the other underside. And it's called Wait a While because if you get tangled up in it, you have no choice but to wait a while. Guide was being cute with one of my students and said that someone had backed into one of these and had been trapped for 18 months. My student, being a little naive, said, was he still alive? The most ubiquitous plant in the north along the coast is sugarcane. There's sugarcane grown for a strip along the coast of, what, 1,000 kilometers, 1,500 kilometers? A long ways along the coast. And you can see sugarcane processing. Some cane is still burned. There's a movement away from burning the cane before harvest and toward just harvesting it green. But in the winter, winter and spring, you can see sugarcane being harvested and processed at sugarcane plants all along the northern part of the East Coast. As you can see, the north of Australia on the coast is just paradise. The only downside of it is that during the summer, jellyfish called box jellyfish come in close to the coast, and you can't swim in the waters right along the mainland coast because of these box jellyfish or stingers. Their stings look a little like you poured concentrated sulfuric acid on the tissue, on somebody's tissue. And while we were there last year, there was a fatality from the stings. Because of that, people swim in areas that are surrounded by stinger nets or go offshore, such as to the islands. In the winter, in the north, it's not a problem on the East Coast. I think it is a problem around Darwin year-round, isn't it?
I think so, yeah. Different varieties.
Yeah. They think that they grow in the estuaries, in the river mouths, and that with the big rainstorms, they get flushed out
and are move up and down the coast, washed up and down the coast. This is Cairns in the north, city of about 75, 80,000 and growing very rapidly, being developed very rapidly. The first time I was in Cairns in 1984, 85, it was a pretty sleepy little town with a lot of tourism from Australians coming from the south in the height of the winter. Now it's a major resort town with lots of Japanese, lots of flights coming direct from Tokyo and from the U.S., lots of flights coming to the from the U.S., and lots of resort hotels being built. A little bit of overbuilding has gone on there, and last year when we were there, because of the Australian internal airplane strike, because of the overbuilding of hotels, there were some going bankrupt, but I hear they're recovering. This is the Cairns waterfront. It has a lovely esplanade along it that looks out on mudflats, and those of you who were here to hear me talk about mudflats in Puget Sound, these mudflats are a wealth of bird life, and people come from all over the world to sit there and look out at the birds. Once upon a time, I guess there was beach there, but because of dredging to the south, the area got filled in with mud and has formed these mudflats. This is just up the hill from Cairns and shows you the Great Dividing Range and the flat in between where, or flat to the east toward the ocean. And a lot of that area is sugarcane. Crossing through the Great Dividing Range is an area of real interest to people from the Northwest, because many of the controversies we've had over logging have been the same kinds of controversies that have gone on in North Queensland in the tropical rainforest. Roads have been put through the tropical rainforest and hardwood trees have been harvested. Unfortunately, the number of good commercially loggable hardwood trees are only a small percentage of all the trees in the rainforest. So a lot of damage was done for not a lot of trees to be taken out. But logging was at one point in time a major industry up there. Today all government lands are protected. They were designated as a World Heritage Site in 1988, I believe it was, fall of 89. And after designation as a World Heritage Site, the Australia National, Parliament, gave this area national protection. Because of the arrangement, because of the government system, until it was designated as a World Heritage Site, the federal government could not act, and it was the state's responsibility, the state of Queensland. After it was designated as a World Heritage Site, the federal government acted. They have eliminated all logging on all public lands in North Queensland now. This is a shot of the Atherton Tableland, which is just up and over the Great Dividing Range from Cairns. As you can see, it's beautiful, lush green, and it's actually the area, it's very tropical, of course, because it's very close to the equator, but it's the area where there's a lot of dairying, and all the milk for Northern Australia is produced in this area. Milk is shipped as far as Darwin and Alice Springs. Over 1,000 miles. So it's kind of interesting that there are dairies up here and dairy cattle up on the tablelands. And as you can see, it's often a bit overcast, and that's of course the reason it's so nice and lush and green. Also things like strawberries growing up there in the winter. A stream in the tablelands. Heading west from the tablelands, not very far at all, like on the order of 5-10 miles, you start to get out into the area where it becomes drier quite rapidly. This was a wildfire we encountered on one trip. My husband's sitting over a billabong. some students by one of the termite hills, right? They're termites, not ants.
Termites, yeah. Call them ant hills.
Right, call them ant hills, but they're really termites. They get bigger the further you go north. Not the students, the termite hills. One of the things I did when I was in the north was fly out to look at some Aboriginal rock art. This is a kind of rural runway. We flew over it a couple of times to shoo the horses off before we landed. This is the country we flew over to get there. This is the area of the north, north of Cairns, out west of Cooktown, for any of you familiar with North Queensland. And Aboriginal people lived in the valleys, and then up on the hillsides, they painted rock art, and I'll show you a few examples of some of the rock art we took pictures of. This was the home of the guy who took us out to see the rock art. We found it pretty interesting because, of course, it had great big eaves and just wide open. It was really kind of nifty. The only room that was enclosed was the bathroom. It's the guy who took us out. His name is Stephen Trezise. And we were at the base of a cliff looking at some art. Here are a few examples. This is a spirit called a quinquin holding its hands up. Quinquins always have knobby ears and knobby elbows as compared to human figures, which have neither knobby ears nor knobby elbows and are holding their hands down. This would be made by taking and putting ochre in your mouth and blowing it over your hand or foot. And this is kind of a little bit gruesome because here's a hatchet and a foot missing some toes and another foot missing some toes. And toes or fingers were chopped off by Aboriginal people when they lost a loved one prematurely, like when a child died or someone else died prematurely. Here, just some of my students and my co-leader. Some more rock art. Some of these figures that were quite primitive are actually thought to be fairly new figures. And Stephen gave us a little lecture on how he feels that the quality of the rock art kind of reflected the healthiness of the culture, where the rock art was good when the culture was good and strong, and as Aboriginal culture has kind of deteriorated, the quality of the rock art deteriorated, and for many years there was essentially no art done in many of these Aboriginal villages. Here's a shot of a bunch of hands that are thought to be boys' hands about the size of when they went through their initiation rites at puberty. Another human figure. Somebody had a sense of humor. Going like so. Notice the end of one finger whacked off. I think that's supposed to be a flying fox. Somebody would be painted upside down to indicate death. Somebody later on came along and put a turtle over the top of this human figure upside down. I guess that's the same shot a little bit closer up of those kind of crude figures before, and you can see hands surrounding them. This is at a place called Split Rock, which is on the road up toward Laura in North Queensland, and it's a very large figure. From there, you know, you have to look at a little bit of salt water as well, so we headed out to what's called a budget resort just off Cairns on an island called Fitzroy Island. This is where my students think they've gone to heaven. Fitzroy is not far offshore. This is the mainland over here.
Cairns is just around the corner that way, about a 45-minute high-speed boat ride from Fitzroy Island. And other than a lighthouse, this is all the development on the entire island. And the little resort is just tucked down in there along the shore. It's a mountain island connection, or kind of a continuation of the mountains from the shore, unlike coral atolls, which are low, much lower and built out of coral. There is fringing coral around this island. Oops, I... This isn't fringing coral, this is a swimming pool. Tough life, as you can see. Somebody brought this wallaby out there, and I've been out there now several times, and it kind of keeps looking sicker and sicker because all it does is stand around the housing units and consume junk food. But every year, every couple of years, it's still there. And that's basically the end of the slides that I had to show, and I'd love to take any questions or comments. Make you want to go home?
Not yet.
It was very well done. Very precise.
Well presented, actually.
Congratulations.
Anybody have any questions?
Did you ever come in contact with those big frogs that
Cane toads? Yeah, we ran into cane toads. You probably read about licking cane toads to get a high or whatever in the press last year.
This is a documentary.
Oh, okay. Yeah, we've encountered cane toads.
How hot was it?
Hot. Real hot.
Hot, hot.
In the tropical area along the coast, in the summer, it's wet. The summer is when you get all the rain. The winter is very, very dry.
And you're still hot, though.
In the winter, it's pleasantly hot. In the summer, it's quite hot and humid. In the south, down around Sydney and further south, it's lovely in the summer. We did have one day when it hit 100 degrees. It happened to be the day we arrived last year. But I'd say in Sydney in the summer, it was on average of 75 to maybe 85 or 90. And not so hot, not so dry, not so wet.
The equator, are the days long?
The day, when you're close to the equator, the days are always the same length.
Oh.
Basically 12 hours a day.
Oh. Okay.
And when the sun goes down, it is down. Oh, okay. You know, you don't have twilight like we have here. No. It's just the sun drops and boom.
Oh.
So you get beautiful sunsets at, 6:30 or 7 in the evening.
Oh.
So you've got 12 hours of light, 12 hours of dark.
Okay.
Once you get to that last resort, I kind of wondered how many miles you covered on this tour of pictures.
Good question. Sydney is, if you look at the whole coastline, Sydney is in about the southern third of the east coast. Cairns would be close to the top of the northern third of the east coast. Beyond there are no cities or towns. It's probably, close to 2,000 miles between...
2,000 miles at least, I would say.
Yeah, between Sydney and Cairns. And we flew between... We took a bus trip of about 1,200 kilometers through New South Wales, came back to Sydney, and then flew to Cairns, and then took a bus trip out of Cairns. From Cairns out to the resort was only... out to that island resort was only a 45-minute high-speed boat ride. And it really is a budget resort and very nice. Four bunk rooms make you feel like you're at Holden a little bit. You can cook your own food in the kitchen or you can eat in the restaurant, but we cook our own food when we're out there.
Scenery looked great.
Oh, it was. Great hiking, great snorkeling.
When are you leaving?
<That's
about
it>. Other questions?
There's not many cities at all along the whole top of Australia.
That's right. Darwin is the only major city along the top. And Darwin has, 75,000 people, approximately?
No more, anyway.
Yeah, maybe 60,000, something like that.
What's the climate like in Darwin?
Hot.
Similar to Sydney?
Humid.
Hotter.
Hotter. More humid.
Okay.
Isn't there more like two seasons? It's hot, a wet season and a dry season.
Right. It's hot and wet or hot and dry.
They'll get cyclones. They're a huge cyclone there in what can you come?
74.
74 wiped out.
Yeah. So you get your cyclones coming in.
Cyclone Tracy was the one in 74, which basically flattened most of the city, most of Darwin.
Christmas Eve. Right?
Yeah, Christmas Eve. Yes.
Then it's all tropical up there. The rest of it is very tropical.
Yes. There are a couple of very popular national parks up there, and Kakadu is the one that you hear the most about outside of Darwin. And people I've known who've been there during the wet say it's really nifty, but most people go during the dry season in winter. The one good thing about the dry in Kakadu is the birds, that the wetlands dry up and lakes dry up a bit, so the birds are more concentrated. But for those of you who saw Crocodile Dundee, a lot of that footage was shot in Kakadu and then further south in what Catherine Gorge.
Catherine, yeah.
Yes.
What are the major religions down there? What is the percentage of people that go to church?
Low, right?
10% maybe?
Yeah.
Regularly.
Is it the Anglican English Church?
And after World War II, lots of Eastern European ethnic groups were recruited to come to Australia. So like in Sydney, they say it's the largest Yugoslav population outside of Yugoslavia. So there's a major Yugoslav community in Sydney. A lot of Greeks in Sydney, great Greek restaurants in Sydney.
Greek
population.
Outside of
Greece. Yeah, yeah. And then in other smaller cities, you'll find, you know, large communities of Italians. I remember we were driving somewhere between Townsville and Cairns, and we came upon this little town, and the cemetery was just something like it came from Chicago, you know, where I went to grad school, where
England.
No, it was an Italian community with right by the Catholic Church. There were all these big brick little mausoleums and plastic flowers everywhere. And it just brought back memories of the Italian communities in Chicago. But I guess that's one thing that surprised me a little bit was the ethnicity of the people who'd moved there since World War II. There are Lutheran churches, some.
100,000 Lutherans in Australia.
Yes.
What's the like average Australian think of the average American, whatever, or the American tourist?
Don't answer that.
My perception is that Australians really like Americans a lot. Although the first thing they ask you is if you're Canadian. It's, you know, it's better to be Canadian than American, but being American is okay.
Mr. Bush has not been very kind to our foreign policy at the moment, and there's a lot of fear. He's undercutting our markets and taking out what they had during the war. That hurts badly.
But you're all Yanks to us.
Yeah, right. When I take students, people treat them so nicely. You know, people are always going out of the way to be nice to the students I take. And we've run into the same thing. People are very friendly.
What is the money economy like, a dollar to an Australian?
Right now, it's if you had traded $10,000 or more, it'd be 78 cents Australian, 78 cents U.S. for one Australian dollar. Which is about where it's been for, the last 3 years?
At least, yeah.
Yeah, 3-4 years. The first time I was there in 84 was about when it was the worst, and it was, I think, 62 cents, 63 cents U.S. for one Australian dollar. That's a question I've got one thing I want to mention about the Australian currency. As a scientist, I love the Australian currency. Because instead of having his government officials on the bills, there are a lot of, they have lots of kinds of notable Australian citizens on their currency.